Welcome to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution, one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's episode, we'll share the story of the forgotten heroes of the battles of Lexington and Concord, the Loyalist scouts and guides who risked their lives and fortune to assist the British expedition to Concord on April 19, 1775. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. In an attempt to break the Massachusetts colonists of their resistance to crown policy, Parliament passed the Boston Port Bill, also known as the Intolerable Acts, in 1774. One of the provisions of the act authorized General Thomas Gage, the acting governor of colonial Massachusetts, to undertake any military measures necessary to help bring the colony under crown control. Gage quickly responded by requesting naval warships be sent to the New Hampshire coast, to Cape Ann, and to Boston's south and north shores. He also dispatched soldiers and loyalists to Middlesex, Essex, and Worcester counties with the instructions to map the roads and topography, sample the political moods of the countryside, and discover what they could about suspected provincial supply depots. In the late winter and early spring of 1775, Gage received a series of dispatches from London ordering him to not only arrest the leaders of Massachusetts' opposition party, but to launch a major military strike against the apparently growing provincial stockpiles of weapons and munitions. As he contemplated these orders, General Gage considered a variety of military options, including a long-range strike against the largest store of weapons located in the shire town of Worcester, 40 miles west of Boston. Realizing that this was much too risky a venture, the general decided instead to seize the military supplies reportedly stored at Concord, only half as far away as Worcester. General Gage's plan called for approximately 700 men composed of the elite grenadiers and light infantry from several regiments and a company of Marines. They were to march from Boston to Concord under the cover of darkness on April 18, 1775. This strike force, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith of the 10th Regiment of Foot, was ordered to proceed with the utmost expedition and secrecy to Concord, where you will seize and destroy all the artillery, ammunition, provisions, tents, small arms, and all military stores, whatever. But you will take care that the soldiers do not plunder the inhabitants or hurt private property. Gage instructed Smith to dispose of the rebel military supplies by breaking the trunnions off the cannons, burning tents, dumping gunpowder and shot into local ponds, and eradicating the stores of food in the best way you can devise. To counter the problem of colonial alarm riders spreading the word of the expedition, the general informed Lieutenant Colonel Smith that a small party on horseback is ordered out to stop all advice of your march getting to Concord before you. One group that was noticeably absent from Gage's instructions or subsequent accounts of the battles of Lexington and Concord were the Loyalist guides who either volunteered or were recruited to assist the military operation. Little has been written about the role Loyalists played in Gage's military expedition to Concord. Many historians suggest that perhaps two or three Loyalists at most accompanied Smith's regulars. Likewise, the role of armed and mounted Loyalists present with Percy's relief force that was sent out in the afternoon has almost completely been overlooked, until today. Of course, before we examine these men who risked everything to support General Gage's operation into the Middlesex countryside, we have to ask, why would an American choose to remain faithful to the crown on the eve of the American Revolution? It is commonly stated that history is written by the victor, and the American Revolution is no exception. As a result of the rebel triumph at the conclusion of the War for Independence, those who remain faithful to the crown have often been depicted in a negative light. In countless historical works, legal documents, and even in popular culture, Loyalists were typically portrayed as a corrupt, inept, and greedy people whose blind devotion to the British crown led to their downfall. However, such a glaring and erroneous stereotype only trivialized the struggles that the American Loyalist endured during the War for Independence. By the conclusion of the American Revolution, between 80,000 and 100,000 Loyalists had fled the American colonies. Almost half of them escaped to Canada. And of those, 45,000 refugees settled in the Canadian Maritime region. An additional 9,500 refugees fled to the Quebec province, and of those, approximately 7,500 ultimately settled in what is known today as Upper Canada. These men, women, and children left behind more than their homes. They left behind their experiences, their communities, friends and relatives, businesses, and personal belongings. Many colonists who ultimately became Tories were not distinguishable from their neighbors who embraced independence. Some loyalists were respected members of their towns and communities and included well-educated Harvard graduates who worked as merchants, doctors, lawyers, distillers, or ministers. Individuals such as Sir John Johnson, Richard Saltonstall, Jonathan Sewall, and Admiralty Judge Samuel Curwen, who would later enlist in the Loyalist cause, were seen prior to the American Revolution as leading and influential members of their respective colonies. Most colonists from New York and New England who remained faithful to the crown actually hailed from the middle and lower classes of the American colonies. These loyalists enjoyed neither wealth nor privilege. Of the 488 Loyalists who eventually settled in the Ontario region of Upper Canada following the American Revolution and submitted claims to the British government for the losses they sustained during the War for Independence, only 5 held public office. 3 of those were considered modest political posts. Only 1 claimant, a physician, would be considered professional by modern standards. A small number owned shops, ran taverns, or considered artisans. 90% of those loyalists who settled in the Ontario region simply identified themselves as farmers. In 2016, historian Amber Jolly examined the court records of over 850 loyalists whose property was seized in New York. According to her research, the overwhelming majority of loyalists who lost property in New York Colony were from the laboring, agricultural, and artisan classes. For example, court records assert that almost 400 loyalists were listed as yeomen, 200 were identified as farmers, and an additional 64 were simply listed as laborers. 19 men were listed as blacksmiths, 17 as tailors, 16 as carpenters, and 6 as shoemakers. Other loyalist occupations identified by Jolly included wheelwrights, saddlers, mariners, bakers, coopers, shipwrights, and hatters. 4 pieces of confiscated property were owned by single loyalist women, while an additional 2 were seized from widows. Only 6% were considered professional by modern standards. The average loyalist farmer who ultimately took refuge in Upper Canada leased or owned less than 200 acres of land prior to the American Revolution. 42% of the Ontario settlers admitted they had cleared less than 10 acres of land prior to their flight. 54% of the farmers hailed from Tryon County, New York. An additional 25% had ties to Albany County. 14% claimed Charlotte County as their prior residence. Of course, over half the refugees who settled in Upper Canada were foreign-born. Over 50% of Ontario loyalists were Scottish Highland Roman Catholics. Second in number were German and Irish immigrants. An additional 8% claimed England as their place of birth. At the start of the American Revolution, many loyalist Scot immigrants had only resided in the American colonies for 4 years. English immigrants had resided in America on average for 8 years. By comparison, many Irish and German immigrants had lived in the colonies between 11 and 18 years. Almost 10% of loyalists who fled to Canada were of African American descent. Whether slave or freeman, many black loyalists cast their lot with the crown in an attempt to secure a better life for themselves and their families. Likewise, many Native American allies of the crown also retreated to Canada after the war. Over 2,000 Iroquois from the 6 Nations had settled in the Ontario region by 1785. Regardless of their economic or social background, native-born whites, immigrants, slaves, freemen, and Native Americans banded together in support of King George and the British government, regardless of the lack of supplies, political support, or financial backing. The campaign to defend the British crown was enthusiastically and admirably waged by the Loyalists from the print of the local newspapers to the siege lines of Yorktown. Granted, their defense of British policy often fell on deaf ears, and their military endeavors were often insufficient to turn the tide of war. However, their willingness to undertake such measures is noteworthy. Despite popular belief, most loyalists did not support the crown out of blind loyalty or a misguided sense of patriotism. Instead, most chose to remain loyal due to a variety of personal, societal, and religious principles. For some, religious teachings demanded loyalty to the crown. For others, economic opportunity guided loyalty to the king. For more than a few, cultural beliefs dictated support of the British government. Yet regardless of their respective motivations, the American loyalists found themselves quickly at odds with their patriot counterparts. One of the guiding principles which influenced Tories to remain loyal to the crown was religious beliefs. Regardless of religious affiliation, many loyalists adhered to religious teachings and interpretations of the Bible that required solemn allegiance to the crown. For Anglicans, many ministers firmly believed they were bound by oath to be loyal to the king. The Reverend Benjamin Pickman insisted that he had to remain loyal to the crown out of the purest principles of loyalty to my late sovereign. Fellow Anglican John Amory refused to support the American cause because I could not with a quiet conscience take an oath that I would bear arms against the King of Britain to whom I had already sworn allegiance. Not all Congregationalists supported the revolutionary rhetoric that was frequently espoused from the pulpit in New England. Isaac Smith justified his loyalty to the crown upon religious principles. He publicly argued that his position at Harvard University and his profession as a Congregational minister forbade him to be disobedient to his king or parliament. As Smith declared in his letter to his cousin, Mary Smith Cranch, his unwavering devotion to the crown was preferable to being subject to the capricious, unlimited despotism of his own countrymen. Similarly, Sandemanians, a pacifist sect of Congregationalists, also believed that the Bible commanded absolute loyalty to the crown. Samuel Pike, a prominent Sandemanian, personified this belief when he declared in 1766 that every Christian must be a loyal subject to civil authority, even if that ruler was a tyrant. The Sandemanians were also the first to brand the Sons of Liberty and other political organizations as traitors to the crown. Roman Catholics, often seen as the scourge of the British Empire, quickly found themselves being forced to side with the crown. With the passage of the Quebec Act in 1774, it was no longer subject to restrictions in certain regions of North America. The concept of Roman Catholics openly practicing their religious beliefs in New York and New England deeply concerned their Congregationalist and Anglican neighbors. Members of the New York Provincial Congress quickly warned the indulgence and establishment of popery all along the interior confines of the Protestant colonies tends not only to obstruct their growth, but to weaken their security. Yet religious principles were not the only motivating factors to remain loyal to the crown. Often, economic dependency and patronage dictated one's loyalty. Political appointees like William Woolton, Thomas Hutchinson, and Andrew Oliver naturally sided with the British government because their respective colonial posts ensured potential profit. For many merchants, siding with the rebel mobs almost guaranteed financial ruin. Joseph Hooper, also known as King Hooper of Marblehead, Massachusetts, was heavily dependent upon trade with England. John Amory feared economic loss if he ended his business relationships with England. Amory was among the merchants who protested against the Solemn League and Covenant of 1774, which called for the suspending of all commercial business with Great Britain. A business trip to England, which he coincidentally made during the battles of Lexington and Concord, branded him a Tory in the eyes of his countrymen. However, loyalty to the crown in the name of economic preservation was not limited to wealthy businessmen. Many tenant farmers of Albany, Ulster, and Tyrone counties in New York Colony were heavily dependent upon their loyalist landlords for continued economic success. In other words, if rebel policies and practices drove their masters to financial ruin, economic destruction would surely follow for the tenants as well. Of course, a desire for public safety and order also influenced many colonists who remained loyal to the crown. Looking back at the origins of the American Revolutions, key players such as Jonathan Sewall viewed the original conflict not with the Stamp Act crisis or the attempt by the British government to collect on its debt from the French wars. Instead, many loyalists saw the writ of assistance case as the ignition of the conflict. To many loyal to the crown, the writ of assistance case was viewed as an attempt by ambitious politicians to overthrow the political establishment and replace it with a lawless mob. Thus, most loyalists detested the mob rule that spread from Boston and New York City to the countryside, and they abhorred the lack of order. As tensions grew between the colonies and England, many colonists attempted to remain neutral. However, as radicals seized power, neutrality became impossible. Dr. William Paine gave up his neutrality and declared himself a loyalist after he had experienced too many abuses and insults from so-called patriots. Anglican minister William Walter shuddered at the deprivation of English rights and warned, "I see nothing but the horrors of a civil war." Samuel Kirwin complained, "Whig tempers get more and more soured and malevolent against all moderate men whom they see fit to reproach as enemies of their country by the name of Tories, among whom I am unhappily, although unjustly, ranked." Finally, for those loyalists who attempted to remain neutral or initially sided with the patriotic cause, it was the Declaration of Independence that drove many individuals over to the side of the crown. It was seen by many as either a radical document or an extreme reaction to the dispute with the crown, and men such as Justice Sherwood renounced their affiliation with the American cause and took up arms for the king. So with this in mind, let's return to April 1775 and General Gage's operation against Concord. According to the Reverend William Gordon, several loyalists were present with the British Army when they debarked from Boston under the cover of darkness on April 18, 1775. According to the Massachusetts minister, on the first of the night, when it was very dark, the detachment consisting of all the grenadiers and light infantry, the flower of the army to the amount of 800 or better, and several of the terrified natives repaired to the boats and got into them just as the moon rose, crossed the water, landed on Cambridge side, took through a private way to avoid discovery, and therefore had to go through some places up to their thighs in water. A review of primary sources, including Loyalist claims for compensation after the American Revolution, suggests that at least six Loyalists were recruited to assist Lieutenant Colonel Smith's expedition by navigating colonial roads and assisting troops in locating military stores in Concord. Among the guides were former Harvard classmates and friends Daniel Bliss of Concord and Daniel Leonard of Taunton. Both were well-established attorneys who were forced to flee to the safety of Boston in 1774. It was suspected by many Massachusetts loyalists that Leonard was an anonymous author who had published prior to Lexington and Concord a series of pro-government letters drafted in response to the political arguments of John Adams. Also present as guides were Dr. Thomas Bolton of Salem and Edward Winslow Jr. of Plymouth. Bolton was a vocal supporter of Crown policies towards Massachusetts and was forced to flee to Boston in 1774. Winslow, on the other hand, held several political and legal posts in Plymouth County. Sensing a radical shift in the political mood in October of 1774, he abandoned his estate and also retreated to Boston. Another loyalist was Boston-born William Warden, a shopkeeper, grocer, and barber. Warden had been opposed to the political and violent activities of the Massachusetts Patriots since the Stamp Act. It appears that the guides were interspersed throughout the British column of march. Lieutenant William Sutherland of the 38th Regiment of Foot references on two separate occasions a guide at the front of the column. According to his report, "When I heard Lieutenant Adair of the Marines, who was a little before me, in front call out, 'Here are two fellows galloping express to alarm the country,' on which I immediately ran up to them, seized one of them, and our guide the other, dismounted them, and by Major Pitcairn's direction, gave them in charge to the men." In a separate account, Sutherland describes how a loyalist guide identified a captured American prisoner as being a person of importance. "I met coming out of the crossroad another fellow galloping. However, hearing him some time before, I placed myself so that I got a hold of his bridle of his horse and dismounted him. Our guide seemed to think that he was a very material fellow and said something as if he had been a member of the provincial Congress." In addition to leading the column to Concord, the guides had the responsibility of assisting search parties in locating military stores. A newspaper account from May 3, 1775 suggests that some of the guides were armed. According to the Massachusetts spy, a young man, unarmed, who was taken prisoner by the enemy and made to assist in carrying off their wounded, says that he saw a barber who lives in Boston, thought to be one Warden, with the troops. He likewise saw the said barber fire twice upon our people. Understandably, General Gage had also made contingency plans in the case the expedition to Concord was in danger or jeopardy of failure. In the event of an emergency, General Hugh Earl Percy and his brigade of four regiments with artillery were to march to the expedition's aid. At 6 o'clock on the morning of April 19th, a rider from Lieutenant Colonel Smith's expedition arrived in Boston requesting assistance. After some delay, over 1,000 soldiers marched out of Boston towards Lexington. With them were at least 7 Loyalists who were present with Percy's relief force. George Leonard of Plymouth served as a mounted scout. A successful businessman in his own right, Leonard noted that he went from Boston on the 19th of April with the brigade commanded by Lord Percy upon their march to Lexington. That being on horseback and having no connection with the army, he several times went forward to the brigade. In one of which excursion, he met with a countryman, a fellow American, who was wounded, supported by 2 others who were armed. This was about a mile on this side of the Lexington meeting house. The deponent asked the wounded person what was the matter with him. He answered that the regulars had shot him. The deponent then asked what provoked them to do it. He said that some of our people fired upon the regulars, and they fell upon us like bulldogs and killed 8 and wounded 19. He further said it was not the company he belonged to that fired, but some of the country people that were on the other side of the road. 2 other men, Abijah Willard of Lancaster and John Emerson of Worcester, also volunteered to serve as mounted guides. Emerson, a house joiner and carpenter by trade, was given the dangerous task of delivering dispatches from the British headquarters in Boston to Earl Percy, then covering the retreat of the troops from Concord. Willard, a veteran of the Siege of Louisbourg and French and Indian War, was positioned in advance of the column to identify any ambush laid for the troops. Loyalist Thomas Beeman of Petersham and Thomas Aylwin and Walter Barrell of Boston all asserted that they had joined Percy's relief column either on their own volition or at the request of General Gage. According to Barrell, when the Lexington affair of the rebels firing on His Majesty's troops occurred, he voluntarily associated with a number of friends to government who offered their services to General Gage in any capacity to oppose the rebels. Aylwin recalled, on the day of the skirmish at Lexington, General Gage asked him to enroll himself as a volunteer. Not all the Loyalist guides and volunteers made it back to the safety of Boston. John Bowen was a former officer of the 45th Regiment of Foot. In 1767, he retired from military service and settled in Princeton, Massachusetts. However, because he refused to recognize the authority of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, he was arrested and confined to a jail cell in August of 1774. Upon release, he immediately fled to Boston. On April 19, 1775, Bowen recognized that Gage had failed to procure guides for Lord Percy's brigade. He volunteered for the duty and conducted the force to Lexington. Later that day, the retired officer was taken prisoner in returning from that skirmish. One guide asserted, somewhat questionably, that he accompanied the British expedition out of mere curiosity. The petition of Samuel Murray, now a prisoner of war, in the town of Rutland stated that on the 19th day of April, 1775, your petitioner, being then an inhabitant of the town of Boston and a student of physic, was unfortunately induced from mere curiosity, unarmed and as a spectator only, to follow the British troops on their march to Lexington. But long before they reached that place, recollecting the troubles and dangers to which he might be exposed, actually separated himself from them, and on his return, being known to some people of Cambridge, was apprehended by them on suspicion only and confined. Given his status as a prisoner of war, it was more likely Murray was merely attempting to craft a defense to some of the accusations leveled against him. Some individuals, of course, were mistakenly identified by Massachusetts locals as Tory guides. Harvard tutor Isaac Smith Jr. made the grave error of merely directing Percy's relief column towards the correct turn at a fork in the road. For his efforts, Smith was vilified by many colonists. The presence of Loyalists within the British column eventually garnered the attention of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress. On June 16, 1775, the Congress proposed to pardon all enemies who surrendered, except General Gage, Admiral Graves, and all the natives of America not belonging to the Navy or Army who went out with the regular troops on the 19th of April last and were aiding and assisting them in the robberies and murders then committed. The official reports of April 19, 1775 from Lieutenant Colonel Smith, Major Pitcairn, Lord Percy, and General Gage failed to mention the contributions of the Loyalist volunteers who served with the British regulars that day. It is likely the omission was intentional, as the officers wished to protect the safety of their guides. As the war progressed, the guides continued to provide military and logistical support to the Crown. Following Lexington and Concord, many of the Loyalist guides were recruited into Timothy Ruggles' Loyal American Association. By July 1775, the association was composed of 5 companies of Loyalists. These companies were charged with the responsibilities of protecting various neighborhoods of Boston through constant patrolling party from sunset to sunrise to prevent all disorders within the district by either signals, fires, thieves, robbers, housebreakers, or rioters. Following the war, many of them resettled in Canada or returned to England. In May 1775, Thomas Beeman was appointed a wagon master to the British Army. Beeman died in Bedford, New York in November 1780. In 1777, Daniel Bliss was appointed an assistant commissary general with General Burgoyne's army. Following Burgoyne's defeat, he was placed in charge of the whole commissary from Niagara Lake to the most westerly British outposts. In 1778, he was formally banned from Massachusetts by the Massachusetts legislature. Following the war, Bliss was appointed judge of the Court of Common Pleas in New Brunswick, Canada. He died there in 1806. George Leonard would finance the construction of several armed vessels and three transports for the service with the British Navy stationed at Newport, Rhode Island. This small fleet successfully destroyed 11 American vessels harbored at Martha's Vineyard and forced the island to turn over necessary provisions for the British Army. At the end of the war, he settled in New Brunswick and was active in politics for 36 years. He died on April 1st, 1826. Daniel Leonard continued his legal service to the crown in Bermuda and England. Sadly, on June 27, 1829, Leonard committed suicide by shooting himself. The barber William Warden was recruited to engage in intelligence operations against local rebels during the Siege of Boston. On one occasion, he was sent by General Gage to Salem and Marblehead to receive intelligence from Dr. Benjamin Church, but failed to execute his business. He also served as a courier, delivering messages to various British outposts around Boston. In 1776, he and his family fled from Boston to Nova Scotia. Thank you for joining today's episode of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the battles of Lexington and Concord, as well as other neat information about revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com, follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.